call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources for an informational hearing today. It is July 1st, 2015, and we don't have all the committee members here today, but we have three of us here. So today we are going to have an informational meeting on the impact of forest harvests on fish. We have a couple of different folks here to speak with us, and for the record, I don't know what the contents of either of the presentations are. So, I mean, I kind of know, but I don't, you know, it's not like I've pre-screened this or anything. So it was a request that was given to me. And when we have time, if there's information that I'm interested in learning about, and we have time to take those type of hearings, I want to oblige. And there's not a whole lot happening in the Capitol at the moment.
In public.
In public, yeah. So I thought we'd do that. So
our pay grade.
First, what we're going to do is, so we have two different folks. We're going to have Steve Kramer is going to present, and then we're going to have Mary Scurlock present. And so, Steve, if you could come forward, and Heath, maybe you would want to come forward and introduce Steve to the committee. We have not met before, but
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, thank you for your time this afternoon. For the record, my name is Heath Curtis. I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. A couple years ago, OFIC engaged Steve Kramer to look into some of the issues surrounding temperature, water temperature, in particular, water temperature after forest harvest and the impacts on fish. This issue and this analysis has some bearing on a number of different things happening in the state right now. One of them would be the EPA and NOAA-Cesara decision. Another of them would be the litigation surrounding Oregon's temperature standards, and another would be Oregon's riparian rulemaking. And while I could spend a lot of time diving deeply into each of those issues with you today, we had hoped that maybe instead we could just focus on the science a little bit. And so with me today is a scientist. This is Steve Kramer. He won't, frankly, I don't think, be able to speak to those issues per se that is surrounding the riparian rulemaking or otherwise. But what Steve can do is speak at length about fish. And my hope is that you'll indulge that conversation for a moment, and Steve can take can tell you a little bit more about his credentials and why he's qualified to tell you about fish.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Welcome,
Chair Edwards and committee members. I'm Steve Kramer. I've been a practicing fisheries biologist for 41 years.
Really quickly, could you straighten that chair? It's good. It's like one of those things when the chairs aren't straight, it drives me nuts. So sorry. Go ahead.
For the first 13 years, I was a researcher with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I left there to establish a consulting firm, Kramer Fish Sciences. We're now in our 28th year. Serve people up and down the West Coast. Main focus is population dynamics of salmon and trout populations. We have about 40 or 50 fisheries biologists on staff, so fisheries is what we do. Our clients have extended from our foremost client for years now has really been the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We do a lot of work for different state and federal agencies, Indian tribes, industry, and conservation groups. So a broad swath. We try and be scientists and not advocates for any particular position. Oregon Forest Industry Council asked us to take a look at the developing science on how fish and fish habitats respond to the to logging under current practices. A lot of studies have been done in the past that have demonstrated that we have learned the hard way that there are logging practices we have used in the past, principally before 1970, that can be very damaging to our fish habitats and to fish populations. And so there's good news. We have learned some lessons from that, and there's a substantial body of new research that tells us how the habitats will respond. Our measurement of habitats can tell us how the fish will respond. So I'm going to just quickly go through a couple of key elements. How do I this thing going to do it? Good. So, first of all, these are the questions I wanted to address today. How are the stream temperatures and the biotic productivity, so that would include more than just fish, anything biological, how are they affected by the contemporary timber harvesting in the riparian zone of headwater streams in the coastal region? Now, just let me highlight there, the headwater streams. This is talking about the upper ends of the watershed, which differ from the middle and lower portions of the watershed. And my last point there, how do fish respond to those changes? We'll look at habitat, we'll look at fish. So first of all, as you know, the Oregon Department of Forestry has completed the RIP stream study, which was extended from 2002 to 2008. It was specifically designed to cover 33 streams and look at how the temperatures changed in those streams when you applied the current forest practice rules for riparian protection of riparian zones. 18 of those 33 stream reaches were in private forest, 15 in state or in public ownership. And out of that, they found that there was a 1 to 2 degrees centigrade increase in 40% of the reaches that had riparian harvesting, but there was no effect at all in the other 60 reaches where there had been harvesting. And the big question then is, well, do those do the biological responses in the streams indicate that there's now a need to revise the forest standards given that there was an increase in temperature that was observed in a portion of the streams? Here's what the data look like. Let me quickly explain how these box plots work, in case you're not familiar with them. The box in purple, that represents the central 50%, so 25% on each side of that central line. The central line is the median value. The half of all the observations are higher, half are lower. And the whiskers, they're called box and whisker plot, the dotted dashed lines represent the 25% on the highest end, the 25% on the lowest end, so 100% overall. So pre-harvest average across all these streams, you can see the median value is about 14 degrees of the maximum weekly maximum temperature. So that'd be the warmest 7 days of the year, the max average maximum on those warmest 7 days of the year, maximum of the weekly maximums. And same metric at post-harvest, you can see the distribution, look at the purple box there, has risen some. There's much overlap, but the median went up. So that's the 1 to 2 degrees we're talking about. At the same time, this is just a general look on what happens in streams coast range wide in Oregon. These data come from across a whole swath of private timberlands, but their temperature ranges are the same. You can see these are small and medium streams, and you can note on there the ranges, the 50, central 50% extend from 14 to 16 C. That's the same range we were looking at on those RIP stream studies. So this is representative of the headwater streams across Oregon coast range. This is an example of one of the specific streams in which the test was done. The black underlying plot of temperature there, so that's temperature data. They were hourly temperature data, so you're seeing the daily amplitude is all the waves in there, extending from June through September. The blue line is post-harvest. So this is in the treatment zone at the bottom end of the portion that was harvested with the riparian buffers as prescribed for the forest practice rules. And what you can see is that there is an increase in daily amplitude, both higher and lower. And now these are in separate years, so they don't perfectly match up. But one of the things I want to point out is I'm going to touch on this. The maximum weekly maximum, you can see right at about between July 15th and August 1st on that, in blue, you can pick out, that would probably be the 7 days where you hit that maximum. That maximum is averaged across the peaks. Another metric that I'm going to introduce here, because most fisheries studies are done on the average value rather than the maximum value, is the MWAT, or the maximum weekly average temperature. It'd be that same 7 weeks. It'd cut through the middle of those peaks instead of the top of those peaks. So typically, the two are very comparable. They issue a pretty reasonable signal about the same thing. The MWAT, the average temperature, would be about a degree and a half centigrade cooler. You can see the daily amplitude is about 3 degrees C. Just to cover how the heat inputs are occurring here, so we wanted to look at what happens when you take out the solar radiation by keeping the riparian buffers of the trees. This is so you don't have to look at an equation, just a picture of how the energy is shared there. You can see the arrows in the middle there. The solar radiation is the primary factor that is the cause of heating where you have an open canopy. Long wave radiation is another one of the things where it's just exchange of heat, a hot day, or that would be the infrared, like when you see those pictures of a helicopter chasing a hostage and you see the heat waves. There is a lot of exchange that comes from groundwater. There's exchange that comes from hyperreic flow, which is similar to the groundwater in that that's water flowing into the gravels, having ground contact but no sun contact. So it's kind of gaining energy or giving energy to the ground surface. And then you also have whatever's being input from other sources. And, of course, that transfers on downstream to the next reach. Now, with all those sources coming in, they're going to change as we modify the riparian buffer. Here is a simple diagram of a couple of factors I'm going to review the data on, and they're pretty instructive. In this diagram, it's showing you the benefits or what happens when you increase the amount of light reaching the surface of the stream. First of all, it's central to primary production. So sunlight and nutrients, even temperature itself, will also affect primary production. That would be in the case of a stream. It's usually algae, but it could be rooted plants or aquatic vegetation. Those are the source of food for invertebrates, which would be your bugs, your aquatic insects, or it could be some small crustaceans. Those are the primary food for fish. And so then those invertebrates become the food for salmonids in this particular diagram. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go through that sequence of those three different trophic levels, but I'm going to start with the fish first. They respond very much to temperature. And in this diagram, let's see, will my arrow, it will show good. So what happened was I think it was probably this particular curve here. These represent streams in British Columbia, where what they did, there is a relationship between temperature and food intake that consistently relates to predicting growth of the organism. In this case, it's rainbow trout. You can actually set an equation. If you knew what the food intake was and the temperature, you can predict the amount of growth. And so in this, they took these streams and took the period that's the summer, from June 9 to September 22. And for each stream, they took each day's temperature, ran it to those equations to figure out, here's how much growth we got, what was the intake? Because you can't, in a stream, you're not sure what the intake is, so you can use these kind of curves and equations to tell you what the intake was. Once they had populated that, so each dot in this graph, so if you just take that 40% curve again, let's see if I can get this thing to go with me. Each of these dots represents a different stream. On about the 60% curve here, 60% ration level, that would represent what you'd find in the stream, and those different points are the sum of all the growth they accomplished over that period from June 9 to September 22. Then by equation, you can then simulate, well, what if the ration was lower? What if the ration was higher? And they got these values, so you got 100% is the highest, 140 at the lowest. The key point here, though, is this MWatt index. So MWatt is the same value we talked about, maximum weekly average temperature. And what it shows is that even given this, that they sum those one-day values across the whole summer, you get all of your data fitting perfectly on this curve where growth is very much kind of a molehill or a curve shape, a dome-shaped relationship to temperature. And the optimum is near 15, but as you go up, if you have higher ration, this little dotted range up here is plus or minus 5% of maximum. That's the optimum. So there's a several degree range that will produce essentially optimal growth. And anything lower than that or higher than that will produce less. And it is, you'll note that it's up here, that center line is about 2 degrees to the right, 2 degrees warmer than it is. So the less food you have, your optimum needs to be cooler. Okay, so that's kind of the way that temperature works with these fish. Now back to the issue of shade, because shade is what blocks your solar radiation. This just a sequence of studies here that I'm showing. First of all, in shade loss, these are all different studies that are similar regulations to Oregon. Some are Oregon, some are elsewhere. But what they show you is the current riparian buffer kind of protection under shade loss in the middle there, you're losing somewhere, in this case, 7 to 13% across these different studies. What that means is, really, the more important one is how much do you retain? So you got to know where you started to know what the loss really meant. So the retention is 70% to 80% across all studies. The Oregon studies indicate it's about 80% in Oregon. Now, so what good does that do? We're going to talk here about the on the bottom of this graph is the density of the insects. These are called collector-gatherers that live in riffles, not in the pools. And riffles is your faster water with a broken surface. Those organisms are the primary food for trout. And in fact, in this study in Oregon Cascades, Oregon Coast Range, it shows that the biomass of total vertebrates, not only were there fish, but there was also the Pacific giant salamander, and they eat insects as well, so they put them in the mix. And so you've got your total weight of your aquatic vertebrates there is very well correlated to how many invertebrates you've got as their food. So it's a good thing to have more invertebrates because it's good for the growth of the fish. Now let's go to some of the logging studies. Hinkle Creek, down in the Umpqua Basin, it was a major watershed study that really shows some pretty fascinating data. In this case, we're looking at benthic invertebrates. So these are not fish. And we're in headwater streams. These are fishless streams. So they have a little different buffer. Here's a picture. There's no protection of buffer strips up there. What they found was, as they pre-logging, they made the measurements, and the control and the treatment are essentially identical in their production of invertebrates. As soon as there is logging, then there is a slight gain, and you can see over the years, consistently, the treatment has higher levels of invertebrate, and that would be consistent with the idea that you've opened up light, increased photosynthesis, more food for invertebrates. No response over there. Now, let's move. That was in the headwaters. Now this is down to the main stem where there are fish, and you can see that, first of all, what happened down here, this headwater logging happened. That means it's not in this. This is the main stem reach. There's not logging in this reach. So there's no difference between test and control. Then as there is logging upstream, not even in this reach, but upstream, you begin to detect improvement from the treatment section where upstream tributaries were treated. And then in 2009 comes the logging in the main stem itself, and you get an amplified increase in that benefit of the invertebrates.
Could you go back?
Question?
Yeah. Could you explain that whole slide again?
Sure.
I was with you until... So the head... So 2005... headwater logging happened somewhere in 2005.
There's a main stem reach where the data is collected,
uh-huh.
And in tributaries to that reach is where the logging happened, upstream tributaries. So that's what we're calling headwater. So when they logged in 2005, to between 2005 and 2006, they're logging upstream in the tributaries, but not in the reach where
this measurement is downstream.
Yeah, so the previous graph was in the place where the logging happened. Now we're downstream. And it's saying that effect, that benefit in invertebrates got translated downstream, and then when you actually logged down there adjacent to that section, the benefit was of invertebrate production was even bigger.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Because you see now you see a much bigger difference out here.
But this is showing the insects that come out. But
right. So now we're going to move to fish.
Okay.
So what happened to the fish? And now this, so I'm going to show you two different slides. This one is in the ALCE study. So this is the newest ALCE study, not the historic one, where we found major damage from the practices that were followed long ago. And Needle Branch and Flynn Creek are the two creeks here. Needle Branch is the test. Flynn is the control. So the red is the test stream. And what we have over here is grams of age one cutthroat trout. So they've lived 1 year, now they're in their second year. They're probably 3 to 6 inches long. And what you see is the logging happened right here, and the weight gain substantially increased in that group after logging. Similarly, you could just look at another, how about numbers of fish? The numbers went up. And then what you also see, it just happens coincidentally, that the control stream, everything was going down. during that same period. The difference out here in weight gain is a 2.5-fold greater greater weight gain of or total biomass in that section of trout after treatment. So the treatment fared better than the control.
So why would the control be going down rather than just staying the same?
So in all of these, the challenge you have is both have natural variability that you can't control. So there's the control had something going on that was going down. So they have natural fluctuation annually in the numbers of fish that are there. So they replicate these studies because of that very fact. You have to have some kind of probability that there's a difference. They did – let me just go back a second here. You note that in the first 2006, 7, and 8, the first 3 years, they seem to be on somewhat parallel tracks. And you also note that they are quite different in their production before there's even any logging. So there's differences between the streams, but they're following trends that are similar. Those trends diverge. So maybe what this would imply is they would both be going down afterwards had not there been some benefit to the light, increasing the food and thereby increasing the production of fish. So when you do a test of control, you're always comparing their trends, and they look similar beforehand, and they diverge after. They go opposite directions, suggesting there was a significant effect, and in this case, it was for more biomass of fish. Let's go to a whole different place. So they did this over in Hinkle Creek as well. Similar kind of result. In this case, pre-treatment, your two streams are showing somewhat similar trends. They're not tracking real well, but they're down in the right kind of range. But you can see. So one's winning one year, the other one's winning in another year, and in several years they're pretty much the same. Once you have first logging, the treatment stream did much better in terms of the biomass of age one cutthroat trout. And then there was a second harvest, substantially more harvesting was done, and the treatment continued to do better. There was no additional benefit. It was still tracking about the same as it was in the first after the first treatment. So how can we put all this together? We do a lot of our forte is kind of population modeling and the effects of habitat and how fish would respond to changes in habitat. In this case, what I've got here is the effect of shade. So in this modeling, there's the shade. This relationship here says that, and there were several studies that went into this data, which we don't have time to go into today, but there's very little effect if you have even less and less shade, or you have more and more shade, up to about 70% shade. But then you're starting to actually cut into a level of light that would start to reduce the production of algae and your primary production. So here's the zone where you start to have an effect. By comparison, here is the pre-treatment and post-treatment shade and those same box and whisker plots laid on their side. So you can see they are in this range where there is a steep slope of an increasing effect, which would be decreased primary production, decreased invertebrate production due to shade that reduces the amount of production. And that includes both the treatment and the controls. They're both still in that zone. They're providing.
So you're saying whether there's 0% shade or 60% shade, 65-70% shade, the effect on invertebrate production is the same.
That's correct, and that's established from laboratory studies. I've got some citations listed down below, but what the laboratory study shows is there's a wide range of light conditions where you're getting essentially the same. All your receptors that are doing your primary production are fully functioning. But is there some point where then as light gets lower that they start to decrease their output? And so that's clear out there at about 70% shade is where they start decreasing their output. But once they're fully functioning, you don't get more out of them by giving them more light.
Okay.
Now, that last one was shade. This one's temperature. And so we're right about the conclusion here. Where did my arrow go? There it is. So the bottom graph here is the metric that's being used in the regulatory arena, the maximum of the weekly maximums. And so from temperature of 0 to 25, we've got 25 is basically lethal to salmonids. So they're not going to be there's none going to be there. But this thing shows the suitability index for salmonids, and principally cutthroat, coho, steelhead, chinook. So their optimum is going to be somewhere between about 11 and 17 if you're in this particular metric. And anything colder or warmer would be less. And here's your values in your pre- and post-treatment for the ripstream study. So both are within the optimal range. And so it doesn't get any better. It could get worse. Just a quick shot to say here, again, that same metric, pre- and post-harvest. And this is now, the temperature's not in this reach. It's an average of 240 meters back into the woods below the reach. So they put an extra probe clear downstream to see what happens after you let this water go and it goes down. And what you can see now, where there was a difference between the boxes, now the boxes are very much overlapping. The medians are a little different, but the distribution of temperatures is very similar. So there is actual cooling, and there's a couple ways to look at this that would show it more dramatically. But there's cooling as it goes back into the shade, because now you remove the solar radiation, but you continue to have the other processes going on that end up cooling the stream. So if that wasn't limiting production, what was? Well, in the Hinkle Creek study, they had some really elaborate methods of looking at the fish. They used what we call pit tags that actually enable you to track the fish and detect them without having to handle them. And what they were able to do is estimate the survival very precisely over a two-year period. And they found that the seasonal abiotic, that would be your physical conditions, affected adult cutthroat trout populations, and low discharge periods were the annual survival bottleneck. But note that the low discharge period is autumn. And this is, I'll show you in a minute the graph, but it's a pretty novel finding. It's really important to understand what happens in these headwater streams. What they found that was the most important element was the maximum pool depth. It was the only habitat characteristic that was correlated with the mean survival during the autumn period. So it went down. Why? It was correlated with shallower pools was the only thing that correlated with the reduced survival. So as they run out of water and don't have much place to call home, then they become real vulnerable to predation. And survival rates showed only a weak tendency to be affected by high temperatures. Just to show you that, here's the four seasons of the year. So this is summer, and this is the mean survival. What you see is the summer period was the highest. There was 2 years of study, and for some reason they only got 1 year of spring and 1 year of summer. They have 2 years of winter and 2 years of fall. And in both of the years throughout the study, the substantial decrease in survival was during that fall where temperatures are way below the maximum, but the rains haven't come. The streams are at their shallowest, and there's a high predation rate. And in this case, the oddity is that most of that mortality is on the bigger fish, not the littler fish, because the bigger guys are more visible to predators from above, birds, raccoons, and that. So here's the conclusions from all this. The current OARs have eliminated most shade loss and most of the temperature gain in small and medium streams. Stream temperatures in logged headwater streams remain within the optimum range for salmonids. There is no temperature gain on average after the stream has flowed between 150 and 300 meters into the forest. I could have cited some, there's several studies that end up showing that, and it does indeed tend to cool once you move back into the forest. More light increases primary production and secondary production, secondary being the invertebrates. And the fish response, now, the sentence is not carefully crafted. I want to say, in headwater streams, of the ones we're specifically talking about, fish response has consistently been, under current forest practice rules, it's been that numbers and growth increased after forest harvesting. The key bottleneck to fish survival, it turns out, in these headwater streams, is typically in the autumn, when temperatures are cooler, and that's when the fish are exposed to predation because of the low flows. I'll take any questions if you have time.
And you have,
What is the effect on the midstream or downstream? You're just focused on the headwater. What are the conclusions for lower down?
Chair Edwards and Senator Ned Dembrough. They taught me the appropriate formality
well
here before I sat down. The midstream would be probably further, it depends on how we define what that midstream is, but the best way to look at that in those data was the effect of once it went back into the trees, what happened after it passed out of the reach. And so what it's showing is that the thermal effect is basically ameliorated, that it disappears as you go downstream. Other studies taking it down 500 meters or longer definitely show there's almost no detectable effect anymore of what happened in that upper portion of the stream. The one study that I did show you there on, remember, the main stem and the headwaters, and we were trying to figure out which one was what, and it got harvested in the upstream. And there wasn't a temperature change in the main stem, but there was a response because some of the aquatic invertebrates that had been created now in the upstream ended up drifting down in, and so there was more food. So there was some benefit. There wasn't a change in temperature. Any of those effects would tend to disappear the further downstream you go.
But how about if the harvesting is happening downstream?
So as you go downstream into larger, you'd have larger streams and different rules applying to larger streams. So the specific simulated values I showed and the analyses were done on headwater streams, and you would have you'd have some slightly different effects because you have a wider swath. You'd need more shade to cover the wider streams. So this was really targeted to look at those headwater streams because I believe that was the subject of the specific rulemaking that was in place.
So I don't know what all the, I'm by far an expert from this. And so in terms of fish health and survivability or viability, fish survival, and proliferation in a stream. So we're looking just at I don't know what the factors are. Do fish behave differently in different temperatures? And are there behavioral factors other than food? I mean, you focus here on food, and body weight. So I mean, maybe that's a good, or fish mass. So maybe that's a good measure. But are there other factors that affect the viability of fish in a stream that don't have to do with fish or that don't have to do with invertebrate food source but are related to temperature?
Well, Chair Edwards, that was a good question, and I didn't touch on it, but it did in some of the reports you wrote. Disease is one of the things you worry about. As temperatures go up, there's greater likelihood for disease. If there was predators, there would be greater likelihood of many of the predators accelerate their metabolism as temperatures get warmer, so they're more predacious at warmer temperatures. In headwater streams, in over 90% of these headwater streams, the only fish there are cutthroat trout. And there would be some caudidae. I called them bullheads when I was a kid, but some of those are up there as well. So there's not many fish species around, so predation's not a real major issue up there. Disease could be. Generally, the one thing that we would find is that as you get to temperature ranges that start to get outside the optimal, and you start that warmer than optimal, you begin to increase chances that you might have a disease problem. And the closer you get to the lethal level, then you're really starting to accelerate chances of disease. So the increase really kind of begins as they start moving outside that optimal range and then accelerates as you get all the way up to 25, and then they just plain die because they can't withstand that warm of temperature.
So I like to vacation in the tropics, and that's great, but I don't like 130 degrees.
That would be, a good example.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Will results get complicated with climate change, right? I mean, are the streams becoming warmer just as a result of, overall global warming? And does that have an effect? I realize there's some speculation.
Yeah. So, Chair Edwards and Senator Dembrough, the answer is not something I've studied carefully, so I would be careful about taking what I say as rote here. But there has been several studies that show in those headwater streams there's no detectable effect at present from climate change. And largely, think of it, that they are emerging from the ground, so they're basically a temperature underground. They're mimicking the temperature of the landscape. So that's not where you'd expect the primary effects of climate change. And these streams are not up in the main snow zone at this point, so that's not a present factor. And where you find a lot of the change that's predicted from climate change is where you'll get that shift from where the snow zone is, that these streams are in the, I guess what you'd call a mixed zone, where they could have some low-level snow during the winter, but you'd have rain on snow events. So I wouldn't expect this particular zone. This would probably be your least affected by climate change because it's so closely regulated to it's emerging from the ground, so it's close to groundwater temperature.
Other questions?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very interesting. Okay, next up to present is Mary Skurlock. Thank you for being available on relatively short notice.
Good afternoon.
So,
thank you for having me, I think. Chair Edwards, Senator Dembrough, Senator Prozanski, my name is Mary Skurlock, and I am pleased to have been asked to share my perspective today. I want to start by prefacing that I did not have an agenda prior to being called on Monday afternoon and heard that Mr. Kramer was going to be presenting. I did not, although I probably should have anticipated the presentation he was going to give. I'm not a scientist. I'm a policy advocate. I have a long experience in forest practices issues, but I would also urge you to consider the important issues that may be raised today in light of the advice that you have available to you from DEQ, ODFW, EPA, NIMS, other folks that may not be from one side of the issue or another. I'm basically speaking then from my experience in the policy arena, where I have gained some familiarity with scientific literature and the issues. And I'll briefly let you know that my current affiliation is as an independent freshwater policy consultant representing two conservation-oriented coalitions, both of which deal exclusively with forest practices as they affect aquatic ecosystems on private lands. So we're not speaking today outside that context. In Oregon, I serve as the coordinator of the Oregon Stream Protection Coalition, a 23-member ad hoc group of conservation and fishing industry groups united in support of stronger baseline stream protection rules under the Oregon Forest Practices Act. In this capacity, I've appeared consistently before the board over the last 4 years in connection with the design of stream protection rules that are capable of meeting the Board of Forestry's duty to implement management practices that fully comply with water quality standards for stream temperature. Specifically, the standard that was referred to today that was evaluated in the Groom Ripstream study that Mr. Kramer put up some slides about. In Washington State, since 2012, I've also served as the Forest and Fish Conservation Caucus representative to the Timber, Fish, and Wildlife Policy Committee, which is a standing multi-stakeholder committee of the Washington Forest Practices Board and an integral part of the state's landmark Forest Practices Aquatic Habitat Conservation Plan, signed in 2005, and its adaptive management program. I'm going to go over some of the basic forests and fish 101 type issues first, and then I'm to the best of my ability, will respond as I am advised by my scientific advisors to some of the issues that have been raised by Mr. Kramer, but that will not be the sole content of my remarks. Clearly, the potential effects of forest practices on streams, fish, and other aquatic species is a broad subject and includes not only the logging itself, but chemical application and every aspect of moving trees from where they stand out of the forest, skid trails and roads. In general, however, the more harvest that takes place near streams, the greater the harm to fish and water quality, and the greater the proportion of a drainage basin that is harvested at the same time, the greater the impacts. Forest practices rules in Oregon and elsewhere tend to limit activities in the near-stream environment at the site level only, that is, in the riparian area, and sometimes around other sensitive sites, and don't generally explicitly limit cumulative watershed effects. As described by ODFW biologists, there are four key habitat factors influencing fish productivity: stream complexity, large wood, spawning habitat quality, and water quality, stream temperature being one aspect of water quality as we generally think about it in a regulatory context, which is really one of the only things that we discussed previously today.
Could you go through those four again?
Stream complexity, so the geomorphological characteristics of the stream. Large wood, which is actually sort of repetitive because that actually helps make up a lot of the stream complexity.
Right.
Spawning habitat quality and water quality.
Okay, thank you.
ODFW described the key aspects of these factors that are affected by forest management to the Board of Forestry last year as being large wood delivery, riparian stand condition, a little repetitive, beaver dams, fine sediment, and cold water. Leaving the forest chemical impacts aside for this discussion, the overarching adverse impacts to fish habitat from private timber harvest in Oregon today, from my perspective, are caused by 1, ground disturbance close to streams, allowing sediment delivery and stream habitat impairment. 2, reduction of near-stream forest canopies, decreasing shade and allowing solar penetration that warms surface waters and disrupts thermal regimes, not just failure to meet an optimum or lethal level, but disrupting the entire temperature regime. Increased risk of landslides from forest removal and road-related slope destabilization, and the perpetuation of predominantly young forests or clear cuts in riparian areas, depriving streams of the larger downed wood that's necessary to regulate in-stream sediments and to form the types of in-stream habitats with which our wild native fishes evolved. Numerous authoritative sources are available supporting the need to increase stream protection from logging on private lands in Oregon in order to protect and restore native fish. These include, but are not by any means limited to, a 1995 report to the Oregon Legislature, some of you may remember as the Bakken Report, a 1999 report by the state's independent multidisciplinary science team, and a series of findings by a host of federal agencies in connection with Endangered Species Act salmon listings, water quality standards compliance under the Clean Water Act, coastal water pollution control under the Coastal Zone Management Act, and others. Provided you with my written piece, which I threw together based on work that I've been doing, I won't read for you the quotes from those sources, but they confirm that there is a strong consensus, I think, around the need for increased riparian protection on small and medium fish-bearing streams, not just salmon, steelhead, and bull trout streams, and on at least some non-fish streams. And there's also concern raised about the current management of landslide-prone slopes and the increased risk of landslides that may be occurring under current management and the effects of legacy roads. The implications or the relevance to current policy debate of the remarks by Mr. Kramer are, in my view, intended to question the basis for the protecting cold water standard and the measures that are being currently considered by the Board of Forestry to meet that standard. And I am advised and believe it to be true that the information that Mr. Kramer has shared with us is not new to the folks that are working on this issue at various levels of government, and that these phenomena were considered by DEQ and EPA in the promulgation of the PCW. And I would commend to you a couple of folks that are experts in this area, one of whom is a gentleman who participated with the EPA in the development of the state's temperature standards, including the protecting cold water standard, Mr. Dale McCullough of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. He's got to be one of the world's leading experts on fish and stream temperature, as well as Josh Seeds and others at the Department of Environmental Quality. I think that it is important for us to think about what the basis is for our water quality standards, but I also think that we need to be careful about questioning standards that have been duly promulgated and which are in force and which are the subject of ongoing policy development in another forum. So I'm unclear about what the timing is of making this inquiry, but I wanted to address a couple of other things before I move on, and in case I run out of time. One would be to point out to you that some of the data that a good deal of the data that was shared with you today is from a paired watershed study that I think is a good study, but I think is something that we need to recognize the inherent limits of as a localized study when we are using that data to inform statewide public policy. So that is an issue that we have. I have an extensive response on what those we think those limits are, and how this information should be viewed in light of the board's valiant 4 years of work now, well, you could call it 12 years of work, to develop rules to meet the water quality standard that it is obliged to meet. And I also wanted to point out in response to one of your questions, food is one factor, and productivity is definitely one factor, but that we again believe that that the relationships between light, productivity, fish growth have been taken into account in the promulgation of the current standard. And we further agree that fish and aquatic life can die of other things than elevated stream temperatures. And also to really point out that the Protecting Cold Water Standard is a standard that is not intended to protect against lethal elevation of stream temperatures by shade. It's intended to keep the level of impact by forest practices on streams at the virtually undetectable level, because this was deemed to be the only the level at which we could be considered to faithfully meeting our legal obligation under the Clean Water Act's anti-degradation standard. So we have a principle that's really embedded in the very fabric of the Clean Water Act that we're implementing through this water quality standard, and that standard is similar to standards that are in force and are being followed in other states. So briefly back to the importance of private lands and relationship between private land forest practices and native fish conservation. Due to the fact that there are 10.6 million acres of private forest land in Oregon, much of which encompasses streams that provide direct habitat for fish, and the remainder of which feed into downstream fish-bearing waters, the connection between recovery of native salmon and adequate riparian protection of these lands has been repeatedly made in the literature and in listing and other recovery planning type decisions. It's also well established that federal land management policies alone cannot provide for recovery of wild salmonids. And that was really a finding of the 1994 Northwest Forest Plan science report. And that to succeed, the federal strategy needs to be accompanied by companion strategies for non-federal lands. And one of the things that the conservation community has been working towards is a fulfillment of those companion strategies for non-federal lands in order to have the complementary conservation of aquatic resources, those public natural resources that the Northwest Forest Plan was attempting to conserve. We have not substantially changed the forest practices rules in Oregon since that time, since 1993. Our last revision was in 94. So the one that we are currently contemplating will be the first in 20 years. In terms of how fish are doing in Oregon, the status of fish populations is largely determined by the interplay between ocean conditions and freshwater habitat conditions, as well as, of course, hatchery and harvest practices. But under current management of federal and state lands, and to a lesser extent private lands, degradation has slowed in the past two decades. But, and this is consistent with what ODFW and others in the state are telling us, we are not at the point where the status quo can support the recovery that state and federal policies both seek, especially when ocean conditions are poor, and especially when we begin to see the effects of climate change. A finding in 2010 is that habitat complexity is generally decreasing in the Oregon Coast Coho Evolutionarily Significant Unit, which is the listing unit of those fish. Given the large amount of impaired habitat and pace of continued disturbance, degradation still outpaces restoration. So although ODFW habitat monitoring data show some mild recovery of riparian forests from the intense logging and poor practices of the 50s to the 90s, and some localized benefits from active restoration, this improvement is offset by declining conditions in other streams. From an historical perspective, we still have a long way to go in terms of fish numbers and habitat improvement. I've provided for you a summary of the current policy changes, the background for the policy changes under consideration. It is based on the Ripstream study, which is one of the most comprehensive studies that's ever been done by the state of Oregon with regard to effectiveness monitoring of its own forest practices rules. And it was specifically designed to test whether we were satisfactorily meeting the protecting cold water standard. I think it's overstating the results to say that we're mostly meeting it, because the value that was thrown around of 0.7 degrees is, A, quite different from 0.3 degrees, which is the standard, and secondly, is an average value. So we do have a wide variation. And there's a scientific way of explaining why the fact that some of that variation, or a good deal of it, falls within what might be considered to be the historic or the natural ranges of variability, that does not obviate the importance of the signal that the study detected from harvest practices on stream temperatures. And it is that signal, that greater than 0.3 degree impact, that violates the water quality standard that the Board of Forestry is currently by law obligated to meet to the maximum extent practicable. So that is the exercise that we're currently engaged in. And many of the impacts that were detected under the Ripstream study were not only much greater than the 0.7 degrees, but they were much greater than 0.7 degrees even when the practices were more conservative than the minimum that would be legally allowed under the rules. So we find that we aren't testing, you know, down to the rock bottom minimum. There's been a discussion about, you know, whether most people or some people do the minimum or not. Most state forest practices effectiveness monitoring tests what is legally allowed on the off chance that during a high market condition people are going to push the envelope, which I know happens. So the effect was substantial, and it was decisive, and the findings made by the Board of Forestry that a rule change is justified was rational and remains rational and will remain rational when they announce what it is that they're going to do about that in the next month, which again I suspect is part of the reason why we're here at this particular time. Other than that, I guess no one had anything else to do.
That's primarily it.
So, you know, I don't know what I could respond to some things. I don't know if I should go on. I will say that the status quo has caused some legal problems for the state of Oregon. We have the coastal zone management situation where we have a disapproval of the non-point management plan. We have at least one 60-day notice out there on non-federal lands road management under the ESA. There have been others. The graph that I shared with you in terms of comparing Oregon's rules with other states in a thumbnail to me indicates that much of the science around stream temperature, but not just stream temperature, around what is needed, kind of riparian protection we need to provide adequate large wood, is science that's been around for a while. It's been around long enough that other states have responded to it already. And we are a little bit late to the party. I have not heard yet anything that I believe ought to convince you that we are on a track that is overkill, that goes beyond that which can be reasonably and practicably implemented by the timber industry. We don't know yet what it is that we're talking about implementing, but the stuff that's on the table that I know about is talking about larger buffers on a fraction of all fish-bearing streams, notwithstanding the fact that we have a federal disapproval that's based on essentially a request for improved stream-side protection on all fish-bearing streams and some non-fish-bearing streams. So the policy change that we're currently contemplating is fairly limited in terms of the universe of problems that we have. I believe that all of the problems that have been called out do have direct impacts on fish, but we do not have quantitative studies, because by and large, and this is true of other folks dealing in this regulatory arena, we use habitat indicators as a proxy for biological, our desire to meet biological needs, because we are believe we understand how these systems work. We believe we understand fairly well what the fish need, what habitats are compatible with their conservation and recovery, and because frankly it's very difficult to measure fish response when you have so many confounding variables. Freshwater habitat is one variable in the life cycle of certainly an anadromous fish, but even a resident fish. There are so many other land uses besides timber, and it gets very complicated. So this is a sort of usual way to do business around this. I hope you'll ask questions. I'm going to leave it there because I don't want to talk too much. So I appreciate you having me today. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Questions?
I do have a couple. First of all, Mary, thanks for the presentation. I've kind of lost track of the process with the board. Where are we on the rulemaking? You said that they're set to finalize this in a month?
We're at the point at which the board is believed to be going to choose the rule alternative or alternatives that will be sent to formal rulemaking in September, say. So there would be, it would come back for to be sent to formal rulemaking with actual rule language after this meeting on July 23rd. So July 23rd would be the decision date. We expect in the next week or 10 days, at the most, I would think, a staff recommendation on what the Board of Forestry is being recommended by the department to do.
And then a follow-up. The rulemaking has to do with private forest land, yeah? Does it deal at all with forest practices on state land and obviously not on federal land?
Well, indirectly, yes, because I think this is actually legally true, the management practices under the Oregon Forest Practices Act and rules comprise the minimum best management practices that are considered to be compliant with the Clean Water Act. But the state lands have gone over and above what the minimum rules require at this point, and are doing their own evaluation of what they think they need to do because they have some competing legal duties. But they provide the compliance mechanism with the Clean Water Act and the deemed compliance of those management practices with water quality standards is what justifies the shield from enforcement for violations of water quality standards for landowners. So it's a shared thing with the Environmental Quality Commission and the Board of Forestry in terms of how we meet Clean Water Act obligations.
I'm just wondering if there have been studies, sort of comparative studies of, you know, water quality on the private lands versus the state lands versus the federal lands. And, you know, I'm thinking of those O&C areas where you can have them very close to one another.
Well, for a while there was, the DEQ actually tried to keep its list of impaired water bodies by land ownership. They tried to do that. That didn't go over very well. There is information about that. I don't have it in terms of, you mean ag versus forestry. The sample sizes are fairly spotty, but we do have fairly good information about the vegetative conditions on the various land ownerships, and you can extrapolate a good deal from that about what the habitat conditions are. By far and away, the vast majority of stream miles are the non-fish-bearing streams, which don't have classic riparian protection, so there aren't buffers there, and the buffers are very small on the small non-fish-bearing streams. So most of the private landscape is a significant part of it at any one time is in an early, a 0 to 9 type of state. The actual water quality parameters, we have listings of three. We have the biggest water quality impairment on private lands of all types is sediment and temperature. So we are exceeding the numeric temperature criterion, which is a different piece of the temperature standard on a lot of those lands, and also impairment for sediment exists in a pretty great number.
You said you made an assertion, and I don't know what the penalties are for pushing the edge of the envelope. You said when you believe that it happens that private landowners will push the edge of the envelope.
When
market conditions are up. Could you elaborate on that more?
I've just seen studies that, you know, folks log more when prices are up, and I've been told by some landowners that
illegally or just log
absolutely
more,
talking about legally. I'm just saying that where you might have been more inclined to do something voluntarily if a market condition changes, particularly if you're a smaller landowner too.
Harvest definitely goes up when prices are up for sure.
To forego that which is voluntary. I mean, that's obviously landowner specific, but I've seen some studies that you can sort of link those things together.
Yeah, I was seeking clarification because when you said push the edge of the envelope, I thought you meant the edge of the envelope of what's legal, and therefore I was wondering, well, what are, you know, I mean, and I don't know what the penalties are for, you know, violating a buffer zone things like that.
I think operational overage, the idea that as a general practice, a lot of landowners leave more than is required, not just because they're doing it as a voluntary measure, but sometimes just because it's hard to cut down to the minimum for operational reasons, mm-hmm. which I totally respect, and I'm sure that does happen on occasion. So there's this question of when we're evaluating rules efficacy and evaluating compliance, how close do we cut it to what we could be considered the line? And part of the argument has come out of the fact that the department has developed a model to help to evaluate alternatives that they developed using the RIPstream data, and the model is able to give us a picture of what would have happened had we cut all the way down to the minimum, and so there's a question as to whether the model is cutting it more down to the wire or pushing mm-hmm. the envelope more than would be possible on the ground mm-hmm. by a real person. So, I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Question.
Yeah.
So, Mary, you said something earlier in your presentation, and I didn't catch it all, but I got the impression that you were giving us a comparison, even though we as a state or private citizens are making some restoratory changes to try to cover for some of the damage that has occurred, there's still this ongoing issues that are affecting and over, in other words, we're not actually catching up or going ahead to restore to a certain level, and I'm wondering if I understood you correct.
That's correct.
And if that's so, what are the theories, at least, as to why we still continue to be losing ground and not being able to make up to restore it to its previous habitat level?
Well, from my perspective, there's probably two reasons. One is that we simply haven't waited long enough for some of the ground that is in a restoring condition to show the benefits of that. It's been, say, 20 years since we stopped clear-cutting across some of the streams that we're now buffering, for example. It's only been 20 years since we stopped some of the intensive harvest practices on the federal land. So if you're looking for some signals there and watershed conditions, we might have to wait a little bit longer. But I guess I would say that we have a situation where we are intensively managing without riparian buffers major pieces of the landscape on the industrial forest landscape, and that is, and we are not recovering habitat on agricultural lands at the rate that we might like to see. So that, in fact, and it does vary from basin to basin, there are places where we're simply not keeping up. And the big metric that I think is probably the one that has the most purchase in terms of being easy to measure and is there's not a lot of controversy about its importance for fish, is recruitment levels of wood from stream adjacent areas and from upland areas. So a lot of the wood that goes into streams comes from next to streams, falls in, it might go downstream, but we also have the question of upslope and upstream wood. And since we don't retain a whole lot of wood outside of riparian areas or outside of the fish-bearing network, we would argue that that's where we're losing ground in terms of habitat recovery, that we really need much closer to natural recruitment levels. And we need to stick a lot closer to natural. We do not have an objective in this state of maintaining natural background levels of landslides. In other words, that we wouldn't have a signal from management in terms of increasing landslides. We get a lot naturally, even if we didn't manage at all. The idea being that we don't need more. We don't need more that don't have trees in them. So I'd say there's a big issue. And then I'd have to pitch roads. Roads are a big one. Private land roads are, we built roads the way we built them in the past. We're not building them that way anymore. It's a very expensive problem to fix. The federal lands have a multi-billion-dollar problem that they're slowly chipping away at. It's beyond the capacity, I think, of certainly most non-industrial private landowners. I think a lot of the industrial guys are doing a good job. I think it's going to be a very challenging. I think we need to set the right objectives, and we're going to need to use all the tools in the toolbox to get at the roads issue, especially on non-federal lands.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sure.
And I like the use of the word purchase. A lot of people don't know how to use that particular use of it. So with that, we are adjourned.